not like the bridge and James that we face, with conquering winds astride the land to land. Here at our seawashed shores, some sickie shall stand. A mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name, Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mouth guides command to the air bridge harbor that Twin Cities bring. Keep ancient lands, your story pomp, cries she. With silence, give me your tired, your poor, your humble masses yearning to breathe free. The wretched wretches of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest tossed to me. I lift my land beside your golden door. I'm Tom. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tom.
And this is why you used to be like. I'm the youngest of 11 children. And in my neighborhood, we were a small family. I grew up in Jersey City, New Jersey, which is right in the back of Lady Liberty, which is what I just read to you. I read that because it tells you a lot about the kind of person that I am. I know growing up that New York City and New York gets a lot of PR and their postcards and a lot of this, in fact, all of the tax revenue, if you would, from that statue. But us Jersey boys always took pride in knowing that we always had Lady Liberty's back. As I said, I was the youngest of 11. I always used to tell Mom that she saved the best for last. Irish Catholic. One of my heroes then, and to this day, of course, was President Kennedy. He was a celebrity in my neck of the woods, let me tell you. Both of my parents were what we call physically disabled. Back then, the euphemism was called crippled. They had polio. And they met in a segregated high school, A. Harry Moore. And, you know, they say you can always tell an eye argument, but you can't tell a money. And some of us look at my parents, both Irish, that they were not to have any children because the children would have polio. Well, they didn't have polio, they just had alcoholism. It was interesting growing up. In fact, all my mom and dad friends, they were all disabled. You know, back then, things were pretty segregated, as we know, in all areas of life, and so it was with the disabled. And all their friends and everybody they associated with was disabled, and they'd come over, and I just remember the clicks and the clacks of the braces, and that sound still resonates in my mind. My first association with alcohol was on April 29th, 1956. You can do the math, I just turned 5 years old. And it was at Hale's Tavern on Beacon and Central Avenue. and there was just one of the many tavern saloons in the neighborhood. But it was where my dad hung out. And I remember this as it was yesterday. And I was up on the bar, and I don't know where they got these little mugs from. Maybe they were for leprechauns, I don't know. But they were very small. And I remember them filling it up with beer, and they let me drink this beer. And there was quite a crowd out there. And a couple of things happened there, as I look back on it. My brain was introduced to alcohol for the very first time. And it was such a positive reinforcement because I was getting recognized. And of course, it was with my father. Well, unfortunately, my dad liked his beer, and by October of that same year, he had passed away from his alcoholism. It is my only memory I have of my father. More on that later. My mom was an interesting woman. She had a high school education, but it didn't matter if you had a first grade education or a PhD, my mom could have an intelligent conversation with anyone. She was very well read. But my mom also had issues. And when my dad died, we went from living in a house to living in the projects. And because my oldest brother was a priest, so we got a free ride. I'm sure what we were making, we could not afford this education, but I got a parochial education. But actually, in hindsight, I had the best of both worlds, you see. I had the nuns and the priests and the brothers during the day. And then after school, the streets were mine. And there is nothing like a street education. There is no substitute for it. And we had a lot of freedom growing up. And a lot of opportunities to drink. And my mom had some serious mental health issues. In hindsight, she also suffered from migraines. And one of the things that we learned at a very early age was work. We had a problem with that. But because my mom's illness started to escalate, she became a drug addict. And what I mean by that is she had three different doctors, actually four doctors. This is how slick my mom was. You know, we talk about how manipulative we can get. She had four different doctors coming in. Actually, back then, they actually came into the projects. They actually came to your house. And they would pump her up with dope. And so, for me, speaking to myself, I grew up very quick. And it was okay with me because, as you see, during this time, I was drinking. And I don't mean social drinking. But I go back to that time when I was 5 years old that I'm convinced today that I am an alcoholic, I was an instant alcoholic. And every time I drank, I got drunk. Because I thought that's what drinking was for. And I was associated with the fact that maybe that I was powerless over alcohol. When I was a freshman in high school, I was working for the Aiello brothers. They had a series of Marcus grocery stores around Jersey City. And my brother Joey came to me. I was going to school, and I went over to the market, and he came and he said that his mom was being held for 10 days observation. And by this time, I was the only one left home. my mom, my sisters and brothers were either married or they were in the service. And so at age 14, I was on my own. The place eventually in my yearbook, years later, my high school yearbook, it was known as Uncle Tom's Cabin. They should have one of those up in the present, isn't it? Maybe it's still there, I don't know. It was basically, as you can imagine, a party house. That's all it was, the function of Uncle Tom's Cabin. So, and of course, right across the river was Manhattan. And back then, I mean, I don't know how we got away with it. I mean, when I was 13 years old and I had a draft card, I was what? Probably back then, 5'11", maybe closer to 6 feet. I probably weighed 100 pounds. But I had a draft card and it said I had blonde hair, blue eyes, and you know, you got into the bars that way. It was insane. Now, if you understand alcoholism, I did not associate with this, but if you can imagine, in my junior year, and I still have these records, but it's more of a testimony to alcoholism than anything else. I was absent in my junior year of high school 71 days. And in my senior year, I was absent 70 days. And this is a 180-day school year. But I still was able to graduate. And back in the Vietnam War was going on. My brother Jimmy, the one that's number 10, he was already in the Marines in Vietnam. And ever since I was a young man, I knew where I was going. I was going to the United States Navy. In fact, there was three of us in our junior year of high school back then. The recruiters would come through, and we actually signed up for the Navy in our junior year, but they would not take us until we completed high school. And one of the three musketeers didn't make it. He died of a heroin overdose in 1968. But me and my buddy Al Tomorowski, we went into the Navy together. And what do you think the Navy is? The Navy is just another drinking culture. So I'll tell you what, I trip right in. But it was also the 1960s, and while my drug of choice remained alcohol, I found myself becoming basically a human garbage can. I would take anything to get me high. I really liked the deputies we used to get from the truck drivers because they let me drink more. And so I went in the Navy, and where before when I was pre-Navy, I had no one to be responsible for, no one to answer to. But of course, when you're in the service, you answer to everyone, especially in combat situations, they take this stuff pretty seriously. And I found myself being introduced to this phenomenon in the Navy called Captain's Mess. This is where you would write up for a commanding office. And what was happening here was I was getting my alcoholism. And again, I referred to alcoholism as that, as a deep alcoholism. And it escalated to the point where I was now incurring what I later learned was called a blackout. These were events in my life that I could not recall. I'm speeding up the camera here because I want you to know what happened. And I'm convinced that, at least in my life, and I've heard this many times around the tables, that God puts people in your life for reasons. And at the time, I had a Mustang officer that came through the ranks, and me and him did not get along at all. And he would tell me things like, Doyle, you just got to remember one thing. I may not always be right, but I'm never wrong. But this was my last captain's mess. And nobody showed up for that captain's mess to represent me, except for Lieutenant Hubbard. And it was his intervention that changed my life. Where I grew up, where I come from, you did not go home with a discharge other than honorable. It's just not, you just don't do it. My oldest brother Joey fought in Korea, in the Army. My brother Jackie was a priest. My brother Mickey and Richie were both in the Navy. My brother Jimmy was in the Marines. And here I was in the Navy. And except for Jimmy, who was still in the service, all of us have been honorably discharged. And around this time, the Navy had opened up a treatment program in Long Beach, California. In fact, the commanding officer of that program was Captain Joe Kirby. You might recognize this man of integrity and knowledge in this field. But long and short of it, I found myself getting shipped out of Pearl over to Hickam, flown to Long Beach, and I was in a treatment program. And I heard a lot of stories from a lot of the guys. Back then, the Navy put you in civilian clothes, by the way. The only time we were in military clothes was upon graduation. And my two roommates were a Native American Marine. He was a young sergeant and a rear admiral in the United States Navy. And I was a petty officer, second class. So, anyway, it was a very interesting experience for me, and because what was happening was because I had this experience with alcohol and drugs, I started to work with these guys that were coming back. This was toward the end of the Vietnam War. This was in the early 70s. And these guys were addicted to heroin. And before the alcohol program opened up, the Navy opened up the drug treatment program in Miramar. And we would air back these guys at a pontoon, send them over to Subic Bay. And when I look back on how primitive that was, we'd give a 3-day detox there in Subic Bay, and then they'd give them an option whether they wanted to get out or go to Miramar. But all there were curtains in these barracks. These quantum, that's really what they were. And on the other side, you can hear people, you know, smoking dope. Jimi Hendrix is in the background. And, you know, here these poor guys are detoxing from heroin. It was wild. I don't know if you anybody can relate to this, but I've never been to Dodge City in the Wild Wild West, but Subic Bay back then kind of reminded me of Dodge City before martial law. So anyway, long story short, what was happening was I was trying to get these guys some help with their heroin, but then I was getting drunk at night, you know, that kind of thing. Crazy stuff. And then saying, you know, feel sorry for them. Talk about denial, huh? I completed treatment, and we used an AA model in the Navy at that time. And what happened was I was working a program, but I wasn't working a program. I guess in my mind, even though I didn't have any conscious thoughts of drinking, because I'll tell you what it's like, I was really, I think to this day, it's just God's way of just giving me the message. I think it's the only way you could have done it. I finished up my Navy time in that profession. Came back to Pearl. I flew out of Hickam. I landed on the Travis Air Force Base. And, you know, it's the insanity of our disease, really, isn't it? Because I found myself at the NCO club at Travis Air Force Base. And of course, as you can predict what happened to me, and I was married at this time. My wife had flown back on a commercial flight with the cat and dog. And I had taken a MAX flight, military flight. But anyway, I lost 4 days of my life. I started drinking it, and I went into a blackout. Super Bowl Sunday, 1976, Vegan Hospital, Fresno. I remember starting that day by getting a head start. And I wound up at the VA. With the Steelers and Cowboys. And I remember this young intern doctor looking down at me. Now keep in mind, I was 24 years old. I was 25 years old. And this young intern doctor looked down at me and he said, "You know what? You're a very young man, but you got an old disease." At 24 years old, I was a late stage alcoholic. Well, I've been asked for almost 20 years too, so give me some credit, right? I AMA, that's called Against Medical Advice. On 2/13/1976, my wife and I, that was our Valentine's Day anniversary, you know, that kind of thing, and we wound up at the Outpost restaurant. Outpost restaurant, the president's no longer there, the freeway is there now, but it used to be, I believe, on Chestnut Mall. And even though we had made reservations, they told us we'd have to wait. Well, my wife says she heard me say that I was going to go to the bar to get a drink. 3 days later, I woke up looking at the front of my house. I was in my driveway. I had a 74 Volkswagen back then. And, you know, there's the motors in the back, but the trunk of that car was basically in my lap. And I could see myself in the mirror, and I had all this cake blood. And that was when I came through that day. That's February 16, 1976. That is my official date of sobriety. The fear, not the desire. The fear is what drove me back to AA. What it's like now. One thing that I made a commitment to when I sobered up was that I was going to take my education very serious because I did not take my education serious. And with connections back home, in hindsight, I probably could have, you know, went to some very serious colleges. But I just wasn't at, that's not where I was at in 1968. One thing that treatment of AA and that whole experience did to me, just like Charles just said, I was a different person. I was so different that I knew that I could never go home again. My family are my blood, I love them, but they're very toxic. They're not conducive to my serenity, my recovery. I changed, they did. It's as simple as that. So I enrolled in Fresno City College. That was 17, my addiction. I got very compulsive about my education. And upon completing City College, I enrolled in Fresno City. And I also started to work in the treatment field. Over my career now, I've worked in just about every treatment modality because I learned years ago that I might have been deluded in thinking that I chose my career, but my career chose me. So I started working in different treatment programs and started to get my education. And years later, 6 years later, I went back to the University of San Francisco and got my graduate degree. And I'm kind of a strange bird in my profession, and I consider myself a professional. And I'm in the addictions treatment profession as well. funny, you know, I got a nephew down in, one of many down in, he's going to UC San Diego. He's studying to be a doctor. And he just can't get what I do. Especially when I tell him how much I make. I was coming back from a trip from Jersey recently, and I was at a bond down there. It was late at night, and I hooked up with Sweden and I was talking about a small world. Found a guy on the internet that's in private practice down there, and he's a doctor, Dr. Sobers, Mark Sobers. And we went to grammar school and high school together. And he lives 5 minutes from my niece. So we hooked up and went out to dinner, and then he wanted to take me home to introduce him to his family and stuff. And so we stopped at the bond, it was the only place open to get a cake. And I left my wallet up on the fucking racing check, you know. And we got to his house, and you know, you get that feeling, you know, it's not just you're right back to the bond, and of course the wallet was gone. And long story short, they got this lady on page and all this. But anyway, the next day, and I took the train down there, and you can't get on the train without an ID, so we went to the DMV in Thousand Oaks. And we're in the Thousand Oaks office, and I got, you know, to fill out a form, you're waiting for your bingo number to come up and stuff. And my niece, she's so histrionic, she's amazing. Like my oldest, she's my oldest sister's daughter. She's just like a mom. But anyway, she starts screaming in the middle of the DMV. I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, she's on her cell phone. She goes, Uncle Tommy, they found your wallet, they found your wallet. She's going crazy like it was her wallet, you know? So I'm trying to get this cell phone out of her hand, and I'm talking to this lady there, and I'm saying, oh, I want to know, do you have my license? She's like, I got everything. Well, turns out that this lady just happened to stop by the Starbucks store on her way to the dealership. She's a customer service rep for the Honda dealership in Simi Valley. And she also has 14 years in AA. So, I called my nephew up the next day and I said, Alex, I told him the story of the wallet. And I said, no, that's not the lady that took the wallet, but the lady that found the wallet. And I said, that's why I do what I do. That's the payoff. Okay, that's what happens when we work a program. We stop stealing wallets and we start returning them. Today my life is good. I thought when I was first approached to do this, I did not know about the knee surgery that just came down, and as each day passes, I didn't want to bail on you, you know. So it's good to come and share my story. I don't have a problem with that. I currently work at a treatment program in New Hampshire. You might have heard of this, Cornerstone Recovery Systems. I'll do this in my last breath. Somewhere in our literature it says, for me, a life of service is the finest life I can live. I am here on earth to serve others. It is the beginning and end of my real work. I've been blessed, really, to work in the profession that plays a role in working with individuals that are yearning to breathe free from addiction. I wouldn't change it for anything. I wouldn't change my life for anything. I'm currently a candidate for a PhD program. I've also had the honor to be selected as the United States Navy Clinical Preceptor for the SAR Naval Air Station here in Lamar, California. Talk about your life coming full circle. It's the Navy that gave me my life, and here I am helping counselors now, new counselors coming out of training and developing their skills in reaching other Navy personnel and Marines. It's wonderful, I can't tell you. It's just one of these things that people put. The person that I replaced is not as name as Dr. Stephen Hobson Walker. He's in charge of the criminology department today at the University of Fresno State. Thank you. And it's part of the process to get this position. It's just a part-time position. It allows me to practice what I'd like to do. After the interview, he pulls me aside and he says, I know you. And I don't know about some of you in the audience, but when people say that to you, you know, where does he know me from? Okay. Remember I told you on Super Bowl Sunday in 1976, I wound up at the VA hospital? Well, do you know who the young intern was that did my assessment? Dr. Stephen Hobson Walker. Is that amazing or what? I'm very grateful to be here. I'm grateful for AA and all that it has done for me over the years. I'm a very blessed individual. I want to thank all of you for being here tonight and allowing me the opportunity to share this with you. Thank you very much.